everybody. Welcome to GCast 61. We got Astral Frost, SBF, and Sarge here. Say hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
We're going to probably keep this kind of short and sweet this week. Kind of light on topics and lighter on topics people really know about. We were just talking about Smash Brothers and how much nobody here really knows about it, probably except for me. There were some demos set up across Japan in the last week, and people have been posting impressions of that. It's mostly nerdy stuff I don't expect you guys to care about much, but I would like to know what your experiences are with the Smash Brothers series, if you would. Sarge, you were talking about it.
Well, I played Smash Brothers 64 actually quite a lot for a while. Mm-hmm. I don't have a copy myself, but growing up, basically everyone on the block did. Mm-hmm. So I played it with them. It was always fun to just play a free-for-all or a 2v2. Mm-hmm. I would always play with either Captain Falcon or Link.
Link was always like one of my least favorite characters. He was just too heavy. I think they made him even heavier in Melee just to differentiate him from Young Link, but he's still too heavy in 64 for me.
I never played Melee or Brawl much, so I don't really know how they would be different. But in terms of the style that I like to play, I kind of choose the middle ground. I don't really go for the heavy or the fast. Mm-hmm. I try to find the balanced ones.
I liked Pikachu just because he was insanely broken in 64. I think he's like in the modern tier list for that game, he's like an A or S or something like that. It's pretty crazy.
Okay. I never was competitive with it. I just played it a lot with other people and had fun. But I know there is a very competitive Smash Brothers scene out there. I don't know which of the three is considered like the one, or if they're all good for competition or what. But I know that some some characters are definitely better than others, and some aren't very useful in competition.
I think Captain Falcon was also one of the better characters in 64. With 64... this is just like even before I found out about the competitive scene, just using Pikachu just felt better than the other characters. And now I can kind of like quantify why. It's basically because in 64, the hit stun on attacks is so high that you can basically combo someone like into like 60 hits or something without them being able to break out of it. So that's like there's that side of the spectrum, and then on the other side of the spectrum you have Brawl, which has little to no hits done on attacks, so combos are almost non-existent. Then you have kind of like Melee in the middle, and Melee is, of the three games, definitely the one that's stuck around in the competitive scene the longest. I mean, it was played at Evo this year, and it kind of garnered a huge viewership on Twitch while it was playing.
Yeah, I know they still played at MLG sometimes. The year I went, which was 2012, it wasn't played. I think they had whatever the newest Soul Calibur at the time was. And then they had StarCraft, and they had League of Legends, but there was no Smash Brothers. But I do remember what you're talking about with the stun length. I remember that lightning bolt attack, you know, that kind of bounces along the ground. I remember if you got hit by that, it would really hold you still for a second.
Yeah. Yep, and that's just one of the examples. Captain Falcon in particular was also one of the characters that kind of got really worse by the lack of combo ability in Brawl. They added hit stun back into his attacks for the fan-made modification Project M, and he plays like a lot better just like right off the bat. Seems like in the beginning of development of that game they had like hit stun cranked up, and then they just like removed it in the final release to kind of like make it easier for people who might not know what they're doing to get out of combos, maybe. I don't know. I can only really guess at their intentions.
Do items get used in competitive play?
No.
That's, okay.
That's kind of the one of the things. What's the word I'm looking for? Misconception, I guess, people have is that, you know, competitive players only play on Final Destination, but there's actually quite a few stages that are tourney legal and can be used that you see.
I remember in 64, the two levels I always liked playing on the most were the Space Shuttle and the castle with the floating platforms.
You mean Hyrule Castle?
Probably. I don't remember the names of any of the stages, but I remember those were the ones that I played on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Hyrule Castle is definitely... I think it's, like, probably the most played stage I see in, like, competitive 64 matches. It's has a lot of... It's wide, but it has, like, a lot of flat areas, but it also has that tornado, which is both predictable and unpredictable, and you can, like... use it against your opponent.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and then I think the space shuttle had the one with the ships that would come and shoot at you occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow, it's been a long time since I played it. But I remember when it came to items, I always liked to use. There was the laser sword, you know, the red one.
Yep.
And then there was this thing that you could throw, and whenever someone touched it, they would bounce.
The bumper.
It was like this golden disc kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, the bumper.
Yeah, yeah, that was always fun to use.
I always called it like the hockey puck.
Yeah, when it came to playing Captain Falcon, basically my whole strategy was to try and land like the perfect Falcon punch on somebody. Because even if their hit percent was only like 50, you could still kill them half the time.
Yeah. Yeah, that was definitely... Captain Falcon also had the knee, but the sweet spot for that is pretty small, I think.
Yeah, and then he also had that kick that had a lot of range too, where you'd slide along the ground.
They have mods for Smash 64 that let you play it online. We should get a G Forum tourney going, see how people would do.
I do have a wired 360 controller, so I could actually make it playable.
Yeah, I'd have to figure out what I would do. Astral, what's your experiences with Smash?
Limited. I played it on N64 when I was late 90s, early 2000s, and I didn't play it for very long, but my friends had it, so I went over to their house and played it. But no, I was always a 1080 GoldenEye guy when it came to multiplayer. I didn't really didn't own.
We just played that 2 weeks ago at my company's game night. That game does not look good on an HDTV, just FYI. I guess that's to be expected.
The fog is so bad in that game that it's like unplayable now.
The fog was bad, the textures were really, really muddy, and when you had four player split screen with everybody firing their gun at the same time, like the frame rate slowed to a crawl and made it like kind of... like a game of luck. If you're like trying to shoot at somebody and they were moving around, it's like, did I actually hit them? You know, it's hard to see.
Right.
But it was still a lot of fun. I like the all the modes that game had, you know.
Well, I have GoldenEye on emulator, and it's like it's in 1080p basically, I think.
Right.
And
Right.
It's much easier to see everything and all that, and I had to mod the controls, so I found a patch for 360 controls, and it actually plays pretty well. Sarge would like that because he is a notorious hater of the N64 controller.
Well, I can see why. It's okay, but it wasn't. I was just thinking they have I saw recently these third-party N64 controllers by Hori, and they're, like, basically dual-analog. They're, like, kind of like the PlayStation controller, but with, like, obviously the C buttons instead of a C-stick.
Right.
And I thought that would be much better to play GoldenEye with, but we didn't have those available.
What I liked about it was the trigger, because no one had, I don't know anyone who did triggers before them.
Right.
And that's what I liked most, appreciated most, because I did not, I've always hated the PlayStation controller bumpers. Like, they don't, I prefer a trigger when it comes to shooting. So,
Chad, do you have any experience with GoldenEye or Smash?
I played the GameCube version of Smash like once or twice at a friend's house. Not really. I was wondering though, how does Smash get balanced since there's no arcade version?
I mean,
like, do they take feedback from the community and then like add it in, or how does that work?
It's difficult. I mean, with Nintendo, it's always like difficult to get community feedback from the competitive community into the game. With Melee, it was kind of lucked out. There's a lot of viable characters. There are some characters that are quite bad and unusable. But also with Melee, there's each character has something that can like catch somebody off guard who's like only used to like the quote unquote top tier characters. So the metagame around that has kind of balanced itself. Brawl is ridiculously unbalanced. There's like Meta Knight at like the top of the mountain and then like everybody else at various stages near the bottom. It's insane how broken Meta Knight is in that game. For the new one, for Smash 4, it sounds like that's kind of the reason they did the Invitational tournament at E3, and that they've had the Best Buy demos and these new demos in Japan. What I think will happen is that, you know, the 3DS version is going to be released soon, and they're going to look and see how, you know, people play that, and then they'll have like some kind of, they'll incorporate it into the Wii U version when that's released, and then backport the changes into the 3DS version. So thankfully it's kind of a new world with patches. Hopefully they don't get like too patch happy. I heard that was like a criticism of Injustice, is that they like tweaked everything up and down with like constant patches, and people got sick of trying to learn characters just because they kept changing with every patch. So hopefully they'll strike a good balance.
That seems like it would be too much, like as far as like Injustice keep releasing patches.
Mm-hmm.
Like Virtual Fighter, they'll like take all the changes and put it in like one big major patch. Like there'll be version B, version C, version D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not really. It's been a while since the Virtual Fighters came out though, right?
Yeah. And that's, well, that's the thing about like Virtual Fighter with Tekken. They'll do like these test arcades,
mm-hmm.
where they'll like get people to come in, typically Japanese, but sometimes they'll do them in the US, and they'll get like people to come in, play it, and they'll go and take that feedback back before like the console version comes out.
Mm-hmm.
So like the PlayStation 3 version of Virtual Fighter 5 was version B. When it came out, and then when the 360 version came out, that was like version D.
Mm-hmm.
And each version, of course, has like, you know, changes to the balance and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, see, I wasn't aware until like recently that was like one of the reasons they did the whole arcade circuit kind of thing. But I guess it makes sense, you know, kind of beta test it in arcades or whatever.
I'm surprised to hear about that level of sort of developer patching and balancing and all that on a console game.
Mm-hmm.
It's been the norm in PC multiplayer games for a while, but you don't really hear about it much on consoles. I mean, prior to hearing about this, the only time I had ever heard about it was some of the stuff that Bungie did with Halo, and that was really because Halo had such a huge emphasis on its online component.
Mm-hmm.
They rebalanced Halo 2 a couple of times. I don't know what they did in Halo 3, but I do know that they've tweaked it every now and again.
Mm. Well, I think it's console fighters are becoming like more and more standard in, you know, these big competitions like Evo, you know?
Yeah. Well, Evo's been around for a good long while now.
Right. But it feels like the most recent one, like the Twitch audience just kind of like blew up. You know, it feels like it's been blowing up in the past couple of years. So, and I definitely do think that like NetherRealm with Mortal Kombat and Injustice, they've definitely kind of targeted it towards that kind of community. Okay, so next topic, Angry Video Game Nerd the movie. Does anybody care about this topic at all besides me?
The only thing I know about this Angry Video Game Nerd is that he's called the Angry Video Game Nerd. I know literally nothing else.
Okay, so that's Sarge out of the way. What about you guys?
I have never watched Angry Video Game Nerd. Like, it's never been something that I like actively dislike. It's just, you know, I've just never gotten around to watching.
Yeah.
Did he do a Battletoads video?
Yes.
Yeah, I liked that. That's all I've seen. I have known nothing about the movie.
Okay, so we're gonna go. For the record, I like the movie. It's not a perfect movie, but it's pretty neat. If you guys are interested in like the whole ET cartridge bearing phenomena, I know like Spooky would probably be big on that. You should probably check it out. Goes off the rails pretty hard, but in a way that's entertaining enough, I think. And you don't really have to be super familiar with his stuff or his videos online. It kind of like does a quick rundown of what he's about. I mean, it's kind of like a simple concept to grasp, right? I mean, he does these reviews of old games and he gets mad at them. I mean, that's pretty much what he's been online. But, well, you guys should watch it, I think.
So it's like a Western version of Game Center CX.
I have no idea what that is.
You can Google it one day, but it's Game
Center. Yeah. With the that guy who I always feel sorry for.
Yeah, I can't even remember his name. It's been so long since I've watched him, but pretty entertaining.
Yeah, I watched the Balloon Fighter episode, and that was a ton of fun.
So like, did he like make this all with like his own money, or do you take like, do you make like a Kickstarter or some type of crowdfunding campaign?
Yeah, he went up 3 years ago. He put up a Indiegogo. I think it was for like 80,000 was the goal, and he ended up getting like 500,000. And it was, I really like him, or the person he comes across as in videos. Seems like a very down-to-earth person who's very passionate about, you know, filmmaking. His site has like a ton of non-Angry Video Game Nerd series. You know, he does this series called Monster Madness every year, where every day in October he kind of reviews a different classic horror movie or horror series. Like, he's done like all the Halloween movies, all the Friday the 13th movies. And it's something you can tell he's very passionate about. So when he, you know, kind of crossed that goal, by such a large amount, like I was grinning from ear to ear for him just because I could tell, you know, he was like so excited about it. It's kind of surreal watching the fruits of that now, you know, 3 years later. But yeah, I really like, James Rolfe. He seems like a great guy.
So production-wise, it looks pretty good since he got so much money.
I mean, some elements really do look good. There's like a they shot on location in like the desert and in California, and there's definitely sets that look good. Like there's like a dream sequence. This isn't really a spoiler. There's a dream sequence that's kind of like. Like zombie genre, that looks really good. But he's a big fan of like B movies, and there's definitely a lot of like B movie elements where he can get away with it, which is pretty much like all over the place. Like in like the last, this is kind of a spoiler, but in like the last 20 minutes, there's like like a, you know, in the old Godzilla movies where the people would be like dressed up in suits, you know, they'd be like rampaging around like a cardboard city or whatever. That's kind of what happens.
Yeah, some Power Rangers type shit.
Right. So, it, like, that could have been done in CG if you wanted to, but it's definitely, obviously not. Like, he's, you can definitely tell he's, like, destroying, like, cardboard buildings and stuff. And it's fun. It's entertaining. It's kind of a ride.
So how much is he charging for it?
I think it's only on Vimeo right now. It's, like, $5 to rent and $10 to own. Let me see. I bought it just because I wanted to. I missed out on the Indiegogo because that was right before I came to Boston and before I actually started making any semblance of money. So I was pretty broke at the time. Yeah, $5 to rent, $10 to buy.
That's interesting. I haven't written anything from Vimeo yet. It seems like they just started that like a few months ago.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that sounds about right. I've started hearing more and more about their on-demand stuff. It seems like kind of like the indie movie kind of place for people to put their movies up on. Now that, it seems like, people can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like Vimeo was like originally kind of a YouTube competitor, but then they realized like they could get a lot more mileage out of like focusing on indie filmmakers and stuff. And I think that's where their market is pretty much grown.
Yeah, they even have like a whole channel that's dedicated to like creation, like showing you like how to make movies, like how to set up your camera and things like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I remember because I recommended it to Spoolie like a long time ago.
Spoolie wants to make movies?
Yeah, it was, I can't remember what the context was, but I remember seeing it.
Yeah, maybe I'll have to look that up later. I'm kind of tangentially interested in that.
Oh, yeah, it's at the, wait, what do you leave? at the bottom of the screen in help, it has something called Video School.
Ah.
So, yeah, a lot of helpful stuff.
Cool. Yeah, I'm bookmarking this. Sweet, thanks for that, dude.
No problem. I'm kind of shocked that Vimeo is still around because, you know, video is such a expensive thing to do handle with as far as, like, bandwidth is concerned.
Right. Yeah, definitely. That's why I kind of said, like, they probably saw that they weren't working out as a YouTube competitor and they just, it's kind of the same thing like Twitch did, you know, they saw that, you know, Ustream general streaming wasn't doing that great, but video game streaming was taking off. All right, what I missed? People are laughing about stuff.
The resurrection of an old joke. That's all.
Anyway.
Some people can't contain their laughter very well.
Cool. So, next topic. Astral, if you have to, like, disconnect your mic and go, like, laugh for a couple minutes.
No, don't worry, I'm fine.
Okay. So, we got this, the Zoe Quinn thing. Seems like it's come to a head with this Game Overgate stuff. We've been having a discussion about it in the thread for it. Have any of you guys wanted to chime in?
What's the name of the thread?
It's the Phil Fish Polytron hacked thread.
Okay, I think I might have clicked on this once.
Okay.
So obviously you're an expert about this. This was the girl who got mixed up with a bunch of guys in the industry or something or other, and people posted some of her personal private life stuff on the internet, and a bunch of people got mad, and it turned into idiots versus idiots. And
that's a pretty good summation, I think.
Well, I mean, if you kind of get a breakdown, it all kind of started with her ex-boyfriend.
Right.
He made a post, a very, very long... Well, actually, he made a website, and a whole WordPress blog called the Zoe Post, where he basically detailed, like, all the horrible things that she... I don't know if you can curse her, but, like, all the horrible things that she did to him, and it's really, really long.
Mm-hmm.
She does not come across as a good person.
No.
That's what I've heard. I mean, was it personal stuff that shouldn't have been aired on the internet, though? I mean, what was the purpose of putting it on the internet for everyone to see?
Well, the whole gist of why he did this was because that she has this sense of propping herself up and like trying to be like this, like, I don't know, this kind of like role model for like how to act. And he basically just wanted to like tear down that entire notion. So it's in general, I mean, it's nothing that should be on the internet.
It's really petty.
Everybody handles breakups in like different ways, but.
Right. Well, there are a lot of sanctimonious assholes out there, but you don't need to make a website every time one of them does something mean to you.
Right.
Yeah.
So that kind of, I mean, that's where it started, where it kind of ended up as right now is that there's a group of people who want, the gaming media to be like more transparent and more open and less, you know, susceptible to, in connections and whatnot. And there's the other group that have been getting, like, how do I describe this? There's a...
I know she developed a game or took part in the development of a game called Depression Quest. Am I right?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think there's a link that I'm missing, because there's that and then there's something about the transparency of the gaming press. So what's the connection?
So one of the things that the ex-boyfriend revealed was that she had gotten together with a Kotaku writer who may or may not have, I think he didn't actually end up writing about her game, but I think he posited that that's why she got together with him, so that she could get him to write about her game.
To get a picture for it?
Right. And this is kind of, this incident has kind of like become like the rallying cry of like people who want, changes in gaming media, which is all.
Well, there's already a lot of reason to want that. I mean,
right, exactly.
They're not exactly transparent, and a lot of times they do seem pretty paid off, and we don't know exactly if or how. I mean, I can understand that.
Right, but it just seems like it feels very non-genuine that like this is the incident that's like this is the one that's over the line, considering like
right
how things have been before. It feels like it's only like blown up so huge because she's a woman. Like that's kind of the gist that I get.
Well, to think of an example, one that immediately comes to mind was the whole GameSpot Canon Lynch fiasco.
Right.
To me, that was a much more important and relevant example of wanting better transparency from the game press.
Right.
Than some girl who got together with some guy and used his influence to... I mean, yeah, that's obviously kind of, unscrupulous, but it's not as big a deal as people actually getting bribed and advertising things that they're then supposed to objectively review.
Right.
Because that's a conflict of interest.
Exactly. And I think that's kind of like, it's kind of like an obvious thing that should never happen. A closer example would also be, I brought this up in the thread, Ryan Payton, who worked at Kojima Productions, I want to say.
Yeah.
He developed an indie mobile game, Republique. It was on Kickstarter. And it was, like, I think it was self-described as, like, the first hardcore game for iPhone or something like that. And he got a lot of his friends in traditional gaming journalism to write about it. And these are people who have never written about, you know, mobile gaming before in a kind capacity, in a serious capacity. And so I'm sitting here wondering, like, there's obviously, like some kind of inbreeding there, where he's, like, leveraging influence and using his connections. And that didn't blow up in the same way this did, but, you know.
Well, I think the big difference is that Ryan Payne didn't, well, the sense is that Ryan Payne didn't sleep with anyone. I mean, it's that whole issue with sex that's coming up for favors. I mean, if you think about, like, Giant Bomb, like a lot of their coverage is based on, like, people that they're friends with in the industry. Like, they talk a lot about, you know, Harmonix products. Mm-hmm. Greg Kasaba, who used to work at GameSpot, they were really heavy on his indie game. Not Transistor. What was the one before that?
Bastion.
Bastion, yes. Right. Even to the point where they had to get somebody else to review it. Somebody who was, like, outside. I can't remember who reviewed it. Mm-hmm. But I remember even then, like, somebody made a post on YoGraph about, you know, isn't this a conflict of interest that they're so heavily promoting Bastion because they're friends with Greg and Sab?
Right, but that hasn't spawned, like,
yeah, I know.
20 pages on NeoGAF or 20 threads.
And, like, the vitriol that she's getting, the whole vitriol aspect of it is a little bit over the top.
Yeah, it's very, very nasty. But I do think you do have a point there that it's probably more serious this time just because sex does seem to be involved. But I'm not sure if that's enough to justify everything that's...
Yeah, I'm not trying to say it justifies. I'm just saying that, you know, whenever you bring sex into the mix, it kind of, like, sends people... his emotions even higher.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's a careful line that you have to walk there, which is if you have connections in an industry and you want to use them to gain exposure for something that you're doing, I don't necessarily think that that's a problem. But what I think is a problem is when you ask people to write something the way you want them to write it, as opposed to, you know, this is what I'm working on, would you mind giving it a little bit of exposure, and just sort of letting the opinion, if it's going to be an opinion piece or a review or something, fall where it may. So, right. You know, to go back to the whole Kane and Lynch things, like, if you've got money changing hands and ads being put up on a website, then, you know, you can't have that happening alongside a review that's supposed to be objective. And if What's-Her-Face is, you know, in a sort of cynical fashion, using sex to leverage a positive opinion piece from someone who works for a prominent gaming website, then that's, I would say that that's not as big of a deal as actual money changing hands, but I would definitely say that's shady and definitely not cool at all.
It's not very classy, to put it contritely. At the same time, I think her ex-boyfriend was only, like, trying to, like... He took, like, the worst of her intentions. It could be the fact that she just liked the Kotaku writer guy and she just wanted to be with him.
Yeah, I don't know. That's why I'm not saying, you know, that she did this or that. I'm saying, you know, if... Because I don't know.
Right. And I don't think he even ended up writing anything about it anyways. Mm-hmm. So maybe out of fear that there would be some kind of perceived conflict of interest. Maybe not. But this all came to a head, I think it was yesterday or Friday, when Zoe Quinn posted that she'd been lurking in the 4chan IRC chat room and viewing all sorts of shady stuff. And I think, you know, a lot of their text logs posted out of context, but there's still, like, a lot of stuff there that you can't really sweep under the rug with, oh, that's totally out of context, you know? Stuff like, you know, kind of redirecting focus and it's hard for me to sum up right now, but it's kind of, I think it's kind of like the turning point in all this. I don't think, like, the whole media reform thing that's kind of, like, grafted itself onto this, I think that's kind of, it's like a noble pursuit, but it's like the people who attached it to this controversy in the first place didn't do so with noble intention. So I think it's kind of like a moot point, and it's something that should probably be revisited in a month or a year, separate from all this, when it all blows over.
Yeah, if this is going to be like a watershed moment in transparency in gaming journalism, that's a really weird,
yeah,
like impetus. You know, that's just that's strange for, yeah, that of all things to be what spurs some sort of sweeping change.
Right, and a big problem I feel like is, like, what is the end game? Like, people are like saying, oh, we want media reform, but there's no, like, there's very few instances of it being specific. Like what do you actually want these websites to do, you know? There's never going to be, like, a day where we go, oh, everything's perfect, every gaming website has it 100% correct, you know? So I think people latching onto this, you know, Gamergate hashtag, expecting some kind of, like, final endgame, are definitely not going to get it.
Well, recently, as far as, like, 4 hours ago, they've now changed it to game ethics.
Right,
so they're trying to, like, kind of get away from Gamergate, try to, like, if you want to talk about ethics, let's talk about it. Let's get away from this Gamergate.
Right.
Because it's so gross and horrible.
Well, that's definitely good. I think that's definitely the direction things should go.
Yeah. But in general, like, when I go into, like, the big NeoGAF mega thread about game journalism, mm-hmm, I don't really understand what they want either, like, a way to fix it.
Right.
Like, and in that thread title, they're making fun of, like, Doritos and Doom sponsoring game coverage. But the way I've always felt, though, is that if you can get non-endemic advertising, that's a good thing. Like, I would rather Pepsi be writing the check for advertising than a game company.
That's
because Pepsi doesn't
true.
Give a crap about, you know, if, you know, Halo sells better than Call of Duty. They just want to get their product out.
Right, that's true. Go ahead.
So it's just a mess.
Yeah.
Mm.
Although at the same, like, the whole, like, the Doritos Pope image that's always posted, I kind of feel like that's something you wouldn't see in, like, a real news organization. I don't feel like, obviously, I don't want or expect game trailers to, like, live up to the standards of, like, CNN, for instance, but it's just kind of, like, it does kind of, like, leave a bad taste in your mouth. Like,
I hope they can do better than CNN.
I'm setting the bar. I'm setting the bar.
The real thing about news agencies is that people who tend to have money respect news agencies. Like, when you have Jeff Bezos to go out and spend $250 million to buy the Washington Post, like, I don't think there's anybody that for gaming. It's just like, it's like, I just don't think that there's enough people out there who, like, really respect game journalism.
Right.
To, like, give it the money that it deserves. And when, like, I see IGN editors, like, I was listening to a podcast a few weeks ago, and this IGN editor was talking about how he lives, like, in, like, a walk-in closet in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. And when I think about that, I'm like, if you're not getting paid enough, like, I kind of think, like, if you're not getting paid enough to write about games, that maybe your ethics and your integrity slide.
I mean, definitely. At the same time, San Francisco is not the place you want to live if you're not making a ton of money. Like,
yeah,
you can be making good money and still...
Yeah, but IGN's based there. It's like, I know, it's like, IGN should be paying their
Well, then you better freaking commute from Gilroy or something, because your ass ain't living in this city.
Yeah. Exactly.
But and that's just kind of how I've always felt about it. I just kind of feel like if journalists were paid well, were paid a very good wage, then they could focus on their craft and not focus on all this other, like, crap that they have to deal with in their lives, or, you know, focusing on like, I'm going to do this game journalism thing for like 2 years so I can get a community manager job at EA. You know, this is just like a play. This is just like a speeds, what am I trying to say? Yeah, a ramp on my resume. You know, I'm basically journalism, just going to boost up my resume.
Journalism is a career that is inherently difficult to get paid doing because it's not a product that people are generally willing to pay for anymore. It's not like the days of, you know, newspaper where if people wanted to get your content, they had to buy your newspaper. Now, everything is online and people are not, for the most part, willing to pay anything to read an article that you wrote. So you have to find another way to make money. And of course, if you work in the gaming industry, then natural advertising partners would be game development companies who know that the kind of people they want to reach are going to be on your websites anyway. So it makes that partnership that can very easily slide into something that's very dishonest very easy.
Chad, while you're speaking, I could just think it's kind of obvious why you like the newsroom.
and when I was that's the thing about the newsroom is a very gross simplification of like fixing the
issue.
In much the same way the West Wing was like a masturbatory super liberal president that he created. Like, you know, let's have the president who, you know, respects science and is also highly religious. I mean, it's yeah, I mean, like, the newsroom is not how anything's actually going to get fixed, but it's a nice fantasy world.
And so is kind of the newsroom in terms of like journalistic integrity. Like I was like, during the first season, all I could think of was like it was coming to a head, like him versus Jane Fonda, right? Like, she was like constantly threatening to like cancel the show, and I'm like, if this was real life, she would definitely cancel the show. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, when he was making fun of like the Koch brothers and, you know, the ratings were down or whatnot, I'm like, yeah, that would definitely end things right there. That's a better world than the one we live in, I think.
I know. I like the worlds that Aaron Sorkin writes. I would love to live in Aaron Sorkin's world.
When is that coming back? It's got to be pretty soon, right?
It's fall. They pushed it back a little bit. It's going to be the last season. They ran a teaser a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it's always been like my summer series, so I've been kind of depressed.
Yeah.
Isn't Olivia Munn in that?
Yes.
Yes.
And she is actually really good in that show.
Oh, can she actually act?
She can.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know. I know she's done a couple of movies, but I had no idea whether or not she actually had the ability.
She's actually one of the better characters on the show.
She was in Magic Mike, too.
Yeah.
She was in Slammin' Salmon.
Can't say Magic Mike was very high on my list of movies to watch.
I was the only guy in that theater.
I find that hard to believe.
No, really. I'm serious. There was no other men there.
Weird. Give us the full review, Magic Mike.
Well, there, it's a love story. And there are male strippers, and that's why you watched them. The end.
Okay. There's a sequel coming out. I'm sure you'll be first in line.
Yes, sir.
What were we talking about? Oh, right, games journalism. I kind of view it like the same way I view like TechCrunch. Like, TechCrunch is like so like neck deep in like shady shit and like propping companies they want to up that I just roll with it, and I'm like, yeah, okay, they're totally like reporting on companies that they've already invested in, but some of them are interesting, so I'm going to read about them, I guess, you know?
Yeah. And but one of the ways to kind of solve that is that with all things D, and now that that seems to move over to become Recode, on their page for every article they write, each journalist has an ethics statement. And a lot of this was brought on because one of the co-founders, Kara Swisher, she's a tech reporter, and she was married to one of the top senior like presidents at Google. And so because she had that kind of conflict of interest, she wrote out this, like, her ethics statement is like 2 pages long. And she goes into, like, you know, like, if her wife dies, you know, like, she's not even getting any money. Like, all the money is going to pass down to their 2 children. Like, she really goes deep into, like, why she basically discloses everything and then kind of goes into why, you know, this isn't going to affect her covering Google or any other company that her wife was involved in. Although they've separated, so it's kind of, I don't know if all that stuff's still on her ethics.
That's pretty cool, though. And you said every writer has that?
Oh, yeah. Every writer.
Huh. That's really cool. I never really checked out All Things D. I was always kind of like...
Well, now it's Wall Street Journal D, and it's a new team. And the team that was originally there, they've made this new site called...
Recode, right?
But yeah, they had some really good pieces.
One of my guiltiest pleasures right now is Valley Wag, and it has been for like 2 months. Like, it's a little too much, like, if you read it for like, if you read it constantly, but in short bursts, it's like such a cathartic, like, tearing down of all these smug idiots in Silicon Valley. Like, and it's kind of like, I can't really talk about it because, like, I love, like, everything about Silicon Valley, but I also, like, love it when they're torn down, you know?
Well, that's, to me, that's kind of Gawker's MO.
I just feel like...
I guess Gawker does more. They go outside of Silicon. I guess, well, yeah, everyone's kind of... Each site kind of does their own thing.
Right. I don't feel like... Sam Biddle is probably... He's like a writer on Valley Wag, and some of the put-downs he comes up with are, like, so, like, ravenous and so, like, acidic. Like, I just, like, just reading it, like, gives me, like, a burst of dopamine in my brain. Like, it's like, oh, that's so good. That's such a good line. I'll make a thread or something with some of his best ones, because he's got quite a few great ones, I have to say.
And it was hilarious in the Gamergate thing. I guess at one point they did have some demands, and they were demanding, they basically, because the writer who that Zoe Kuhn was involved in worked at Kotaku, which is owned by Gawker. And so they were going to go directly to Nick Denton, who I guess like the CEO of Gawker. And as soon as I read that, I was all like, Nick Denton doesn't give a shit about like about any of this, especially if Kotaku is getting hit.
I keep forgetting that Kotaku is under Gawker, but it really makes sense.
And they're not all bad. Like, I follow a lot of stuff that Jalopnik does, which is like their car focus site, and Jezebel, which is their site for like gossip.
Oh, God. Very, oh my God.
Jezebel is such a terrible website.
Jezebel's like the worst
one. I know,
one.
But it's like the only connection I have with the female world.
I mean, if you, yeah, but that's not a connection with the female world. That's the connection with a bunch of feminist retards.
Whoa,
like the ones that give feminism a bad name, that's the people on Jezebel.
Sometimes those are the people you want to read. That's why you go to the zoo sometimes.
Hey,
yeah, if you want to be like, I'm going to go on this website and I guarantee everything I'm going to read is wrong, that's when you go to Jezebel.
That's why I go to, oh God, what's his name? He's the guy. He's at TechCrunch. MG Siegler. That's the guy.
Oh, Paris Lemon.
Yeah, yeah. I go to his website all the time, just to read how wrong he is. There was like,
You don't like MG?
No, he is like he's like the worst writer I've ever read. I really dislike him from the bottom of my heart. Like, even beyond Daring Fireball and some of the other...
You're breaking my heart.
Like, MG is so bad. There's one I looked up recently. It's like a post of his from like 2 years ago. He's like, this thing will never ever happen. And then like a year later it happened. And I was just like, and he wrote it in such a smug way too. He had this, he had this TechCrunch post that I also stumbled upon a couple weeks ago. That was like, his return to writing guest posts on TechCrunch, and it was just so smug and full of himself, and the title of it was like, I return to you now at the turn of the tide. It's like, get the fuck out of here. No one cares about your fucking Lord of the Rings references. Yeah, shut the fuck up.
There's probably nothing worse than like a self-aggrandizing guy who thinks he's really witty
trying to
write an article, and then it's really bad and really wrong. Like, you just read the whole thing and you're like, this guy has no idea how big of an ass of himself he is making right now. Like, it's amazing.
That is such his MO. I'm just like, I'm sitting here just like stewing in like, I can't believe you guys made me think of him.
That's the reason why I like MG and I like Gruber, is because they are just assholes. But to me, it's like they never talk about things wrongly that I care about, so I can just like sit.
I guess that's true. For me, the problem is that they speak way too often about Google, and they're almost always wrong or misguided.
Yeah. Now, when you say they're wrong, does that mean they're being critical of Google? Because I know how much you like Google.
They're being critical of Google, and they're saying, like, Google is doing this because of some philosophy that their entire company believes in, that they'll never, ever change, and that they believe it in so much, and it's definitely wrong, and Apple is completely right for this opposite reason, and...
But Google changes shit all the time.
Exactly. Like, Google isn't made up of, like, one person. Like, they flip-flop on shit all the time. Like,
it took them a long time, but they finally figured out that Google Plus was shit and nobody cared.
That happened right around the time that Sundar Pichai left the company, who was the kind of the main push behind Google Plus, and he's out of there.
That was Vic Gundotra.
Vic Gundotra. Who was I thinking of? Oh, the Chrome OS guy. Yes.
Yeah, Sundar's still there.
Yes, Sundar's still there, and he's in charge of Android now.
Yeah, but Vic is like, was a very amazing guy. Because when he came to Microsoft, there was this whole line about how Microsoft had never, ever in the history enforced their non-compete clause until Vic Gundotra left Microsoft to go to
That's
how it
was. That's.
But yeah, but Google Plus was not the direction.
And from the rumors that have been leaking out, it sounds like they're kind of separating all the parts of Google Plus into separate things now. Photos is kind of becoming its own thing. YouTube, for better or worse, is probably stuck with it now, but I don't think going forward it's kind of a big deal. I think the big deal was people migrating over, and that's kind of blown over at this point.
Yeah, trying to get logged into Skype earlier reminded me of how sort of irritated I am at how centralized everything is becoming on the internet. Because trying to get into it led me back to a Microsoft page, which took me back to an account that was linked to an email of mine that got hacked and hijacked years ago. Mm. And it took me forever to get my Xbox Live account back a couple of years ago. Uh-huh. And just now it took me half an hour to get my Skype account back. And I was just thinking, you know, if all of this crap was not completely interrelated and I could just have an account over here that was just this and not connected to all this, and the same thing here and here and here, I would like it so much better. I really don't like having my entire internet connected together.
But you need the Skype on your Xbox One. Come on, man.
Yeah, my Xbox One that doesn't exist. Actually, does the 360 have Skype?
I don't think it does.
Okay, because I still have one of those, but I don't have. I don't have any of the new ones.
But you can't play. Wait, is Destiny on Xbox?
I have no idea. Wait, it's isn't that coming out on computer? Or is it not coming out on computer?
It is not coming out on PC.
Oh, that's so lame.
I know, it's really stupid.
Because I could play it on this computer.
Wait, is this the game that Sony has, like, exclusive marketing for? But, like, there is...
Yeah.
There is an Xbox version, but they're not allowed to talk about it.
Yeah, it's the Bungie game, right? Like, the MMO, FPS, or whatever the hell it is. I don't know if it's MMO, but, you know.
Yeah, but... And I know, like, Sony's getting a lot of flack for the co-marketing. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that people seem to forget that 2 years ago, the contracts all leaked out for Destiny. Mm-hmm. And because Bungie was originally a Microsoft studio, Microsoft had first right of refusal over Destiny, and they refused it. So them getting a deal with Sony just kind of made sense.
That's kind of – isn't that kind of like a dick move by Microsoft, though? Like, hey, you made – a bunch of games for us. But...
it's Microsoft.
They wanted Titanfall.
And basically, they just wanted to pry Halo out of Bungie's hands, and then they didn't care what happened to Bungie after that.
Right. They got
And they succeeded, so there you go. Halo 5 coming out.
5 and 6.
Oh, that's right, yeah. The new trilogy.
Yeah, but Sarge, but like you said, like at least you know that 343 is as good as Bungie, at least, because... like 3 and ODST and Reach were like at least on par with 4, right?
I would say that I didn't like 3 much at all, really. Single player or multiplayer. Reach, I wasn't too big on it first, but it grew on me over time. And then ODST, I actually liked. 4, it was okay. And then some aspects of it were pretty good, but it really needed some work in its level design, kind of like Halo 2 did, where too many levels were go to this area and press this button, and then traverse another area that looks just like it and press another button that looks just like it. It's basically like press 3 buttons to finish this level is kind of the MO of Halo 4, and it's not... Obviously, you know, going to a place and completing an objective is like what you do in most games, but it wasn't done creatively or in a way that flowed as a narrative like a lot of other games managed to accomplish and are getting better at, I think, as time goes by. It was just very, okay, you're in this level. There are 3 places that you need to go to push a button to make something happen. All right, go do that. And so that was disappointing. And then, of course, you have the absence of Marty O'Donnell, which... is really noticeable because Halo 4 soundtrack, you don't even remember anything from it. Like, I've played through the game twice. I can't remember a single track at all from the soundtrack.
His music also, is so good that I listen to it even if I haven't played the game. I've never played ODST, but I absolutely love that soundtrack.
ODST had a really cool soundtrack because it went a little bit for that, like, jazzy noir kind of sound.
Yeah.
So good.
But actually, Halo 4 is actually Metroid Prime 4, because they like took the whole visor thing. And
oh yeah, how you get like a little bit of the fisheye at the edges and stuff. Yeah. I didn't really like that change, actually. I liked it the way it was in Halo 1, where you're just seeing like you would normally see.
That's not realistic, though.
No, but it's easier on the eyes.
But yeah.
But I mean, yeah, 343, they're doing, I would say, decent, and we'll see if they improve with the next one.
Who's making the Master Chief Collection with the 2 remake? Is that them?
I would assume so. I don't think Bungie's doing any work on Halo anymore.
Definitely.
Did they do the first anniversary?
No, I'm pretty sure that, I know 343 did Anniversary, which I actually do have. It's actually pretty cool, because there's a button where you can switch back and forth mm-hmm. between updated and original graphics mm-hmm. while you're playing. Although it did have problems where if you were playing with the updated graphics, certain things didn't work quite right. But overall it was pretty good, and, I wouldn't say it was worth buying necessarily at any price above like maybe $20, but it's something that's interesting to pick up.
Now, does that
By the way,
what's that?
By the way, it's actually being developed in conjunction with Certain Affinity, if you ever heard of those guys, Ruffian, and Saber Interactive. So there's like a bunch of different people involved with doing the Master Chief Collection in various ways, as you can imagine.
The collection interests me mainly because they're bringing back Halo 2's multiplayer. Just with updated visuals, and that was the high point in the series for multiplayer. Like, Halo 2's multiplayer is so good, it just blows everything else in the series out of the water.
That's what I've consistently heard from people online and in real life, is that Halo 2,
yeah,
the best multiplayer.
Yeah, and it's really good. I mean, I've never played any other FPS online half as much as I've played Halo 2, like, not even Unreal Tournament. Halo 2 was that good.
Yeah, it was. Also, the Halo 2 cut scenes are being totally updated by a company called Blur. Have you ever heard of them?
Blur! They made the awesome Girl with the Dragon Tattoo opening.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be really cool.
Okay, that's cool. And so that means we'll get cut scenes without 10 seconds of graphical pop in this time around.
Exactly.
What a gamut of topics. You guys definitely took this far farther than I thought we would go. But I think it's about time to close up shop. Thank you everybody for showing up and your contributions. Any parting words you want to have?
Nobody? Not really.
Nobody?
I can't think of anything.
You guys are really bad when you put turtles on the spot.
Because alrighty, of Gamer Day, I'm just going to leave these words of advice. Don't trust anyone.
Always use protection.
Oh, that one there. All right. That was another horrible thing she did.
All right. Say goodbye, everybody.
Peace.
All right. Bye. You heard me, bitch. Yeah. That's the stutter, stupid. You ain't listening to the words of this song anyway. All you do is listen to beats with your dumb ass. Dancing, trying to get a nigga money in the club. With your stupid manupin self. We was talking about you, Dodo. Dumb. You dumb bitch. You. The one that want to drink that don't want to pay for it. Spend all your money you make all week on that dress. And I spill the drink on acting like I'm drunk when I'm not. I'm just trying to fuck.